Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. And we're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Hey, good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you this morning?
Great.
We have a couple of guests joining us. Nicholas Harari from Restaurant Nicholas, who was on our show just recently. Is going to come on and join us for a segment to talk about some issues facing restaurateurs across the country. And then we have John Kafarski going to come on later on in the show. He's going to be talking with us about he's our sommelier for our organization, both our restaurants, the Stage Left Restaurant Group.
And at the end of the show, Francis, I'm going to tell you a really good story about something that happened in the restaurant.
I can't wait. I'm all a titter. And John's going to talk to us about he's pursuing a degree called a Master Sommelier degree, which if you're a young person starting out in the restaurant side of things and you're at all interested in the wine side, it's a great thing. Those are great letters to have after your name. It's a very serious degree and takes years to get, and he'll tell you a little bit about how he's getting there and how you can too. Here's some news. You ready for this? This is from Decanter Magazine, which is a British publication. This is reported just recently. Americans will replace the French as the world's biggest wine drinkers within 3 years.
I've been bigger than every French guy I've known for my whole life.
Not the biggest wine drinker. That's a guy in Duluth. The report from the International Organization of Vine and Wine claims that French wine consumption dropped 2% between 2004 and 2005, while British wine consumption rose 5%. And Britain and the United States are the world's two fastest-growing wine markets, and we're bigger than they are. And so we're going up. We will be the largest nation of wine drinkers in the world. Where that is from 20 years ago when we started in this business, it's incredible.
Mm-hmm. That's actually well, the whole wine world has just exploded, and we were talking about it again a few days back about cost of wine. But it's not just cost of wine; it's quality of wine. It's things that are available to us that were never available to us before. It's just a whole giant industry that's growing and growing and growing.
And, you know, remember, though, that while we will drink more wine on a gross level than France, it's still not into our culture as percentage-wise.
Right. There are a lot more of us than there are French.
What did they say?
Thank goodness.
2% of Americans drink, like, 60% of the wine. Mm-hmm. I have that guess. That's a statistic that
totally
I'm vaguely remembering. But it's something
fictional
like that.
Statistic.
Something big. Something to make you say, wow. Not exactly sure where it is. Hey, there's more good news on the American front. The nation's largest beverage distributors have agreed to halt all sales of sodas, sugar sodas, to public schools, a step that will remove sugary caloric drinks from vending machines and cafeterias around the country. The national agreement was announced Wednesday by the William J. Clinton Foundation and also will apply to private and parochial schools, who will probably follow the public schools' leads.
And remember, you guys have heard us talk a lot about Francis and I have been on this campaign for a long time to get sodas and sugary drinks out of schools. And this was attacked state by state. And as a matter of fact, at the end of this article, one of the things that it notes is that somebody who we kind of bashed on this show for a fairly long time in the early days of the show was Governor Jody Rell of Connecticut. And Jody Rell, hopefully in part because of the pressure that she got from places like this radio station and people like you, reversed her position, and Connecticut had recently signed a law banning sodas from Connecticut schools. And a lot of states had taken this tack, and this was getting more and more pressure from more and more states. And now what you see is you see the federal government moving in here, and there was a concern, I think, on the soda companies' end that the federal government was going to move in and make a mandate, or that all states were going to move this in the same direction here. And so the soda companies have acted, I think, in their own best interests here.
Well, here's a quote from Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee. who's the co-chair of the Alliance. And the Alliance was an alliance between the Clinton Foundation and the American Heart Association, which helped to broker this deal. It's not a regulation. It's a voluntary deal from the soda manufacturers. This is the quote from Governor Huckabee. The soft drink industry has decided that it won't wait to be pushed. It jumped in. It may be the soft drink industry, but they've made a very hard decision. Okay. And I think that's great, and I think they deserve to be commended for it. But remember, they only decided they didn't want to wait to be pushed because they felt that you were about to push them.
Because we were pushing them.
That's right. That's
okay, pushing them. All of us. And this is everybody. This is everybody who's out there who's standing up for the things that they believe in, who's putting good foods into the school, who's putting organic products on the shelves and buying them. That's how we get these things done, by pushing one person at a time.
And what your kid eats and what your kid has in school. And listen, none of this bans. If you want to send your kid to school with a can of Coke, you can.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why you want to do that, but you can. But the thing is, there are a lot of parents who are working hard to...
Here's a suggestion. Don't do it on a really hot day.
There were a lot of... send them with a battery-operated refrigerator as well. But a lot of parents who were trying to battle the battle of having their kids not eat as much sugary stuff as we face a national epidemic of childhood obesity, those parents who are trying to control what their kids have, you know, you send your kid to school with a couple of bucks for lunch, and the vending machine is there with sugary sodas... You can't stop your kid from getting a soda while he's in school, and the schools need to act in loco parentis.
Mm-hmm.
The schools need to act to make sure that, you know, the kid doesn't have four sodas. That's part of how we need to deal with children. We need to teach them that having four sodas during the course of a day is not good for you and is mm-hmm. not right.
Now, I'm very excited about this particular
Agreement
coming down the pike. It's a great thing. But there are a couple of things in here, and of course, like any compromise, there are going to be things that you like and things that you don't like. But two things in here that I'm not crazy about. The first one is diet soda is still okay. And if you've heard the show on aspartame, if you haven't heard it, please go back to our podcast and listen to that show on aspartame, because I think it was a really, really important show that we did. NutraSweet. Aspartame is the sweetener in NutraSweet. And you can go to restaurantguysradio.com and listen to that show on aspartame, because it was, I think, one of our more important shows recently. And so diet sodas are still okay in schools and vending machines. And I do have a problem with that still. But I think this is a
great step in the right direction.
Great measure. And the other thing that they've done here is they're taking whole milk also out of the schools and only serving low-fat milk. Certainly the jury is out here as in the best-case scenario, but there are a lot of studies out here saying, A, whole milk does not cause you to retain any more weight or gain any more weight than low-fat milk, and B, that whole milk may actually be better for you than low-fat milk. So I think that decision was a little bit hasty at the very least.
Yeah, no, I agree completely. But here, to look at the ruling is still is reasonable in some other ways. It says the new rules will apply to beverages sold on school grounds during the regular school day and at after-school activities like band and choir practice, right? But events like school plays, band concerts, sporting events, things where there are adults in the audience,
mm-hmm.
and things that are purely recreational, they will still be able to sell sodas and the like. And I think
which, you know what, I'm fine. If I'm going to be at an event with my kid,
yep.
and you want to offer sodas, and we can decide if we're going to have one or not, I have no problem with it at all.
Yeah, well, here's an industry that we've bashed a number of times. The beverage distributors, we want to say kudos to you. Great step, doing it in the right direction. We like the idea.
Yep, absolutely.
When we come back, we're going to be talking with Nicholas Ferrari of Restaurant Nicholas in Red Bank, New Jersey, just briefly, and then we're going to go talk with John Kafarski, who's going to join us in studio. He's the head sommelier for Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurant. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hey, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants. Our guest today, returning again, is our friend Nicholas Ferrari. We got to talking about foie gras, and you may have heard us talking quite a bit this week about the fact that the city of Chicago has made illegal, taking effect soon, the sale or serving of foie gras in restaurants. Foie gras is the fattened liver of a duck, which is raised in a way that animal rights activists have for some reason picked on this method and are calling it inhumane, although it's a hell of a lot more humane, in my opinion, than the raising of McDonald's chickens. And, you know, as this spreads and people, this idea of making foie gras illegal, I think it's sort of misguided, and I think it has great implications for restaurants. So we called up Nicholas Ferrari from Restaurant Nicholas down in Red Bank or down in Middletown, New Jersey, to come. And we're going to ask a bunch of chefs what they think about it. We have Rick Tremonto coming on the show next week. And, Nicholas, you're on the show now. What do you think about this foie gras ban?
And I thought you guys were concerned that they banned smoking in New Jersey. Now we're going to ban foie gras too.
Yeah,
I'm not sure. I've served foie gras since the day we've opened. I've continued to serve foie gras. I don't know that it's any more inhumane than other meat products. And unless I'm going to become a vegetarian only restaurant, I don't think I can really get involved in that kind of stuff.
You know, the next thing to become illegal. Forcing ducks to smoke in restaurants.
Yeah. That's probably going to be the case.
Forcing ducks to smoke.
Now, this much I will say. I have flown to Chicago and enjoyed dinner in a lot of the great restaurants of the city. So if any of their customers want to fly to New Jersey so they can eat foie gras, we'll be serving it.
We'll do the stage left Nicholas foie gras alliance.
We'll set up a tour.
We can
tour of New foie gras tour of New Jersey.
Homing ducks that'll go back and forth between the restaurants and fly.
It is somewhat surprising that they're the first city to do that.
Because they're such a culinary capital. I'm amazed by it. And
well, I think when you see. You would presume that there's a lot of political pressure to do something like that, but you see the mayor of the city say things like, you know, we're dealing with gangland murders and huge problems with poverty, and you guys are worried about foie gras ducks. You know, we need to get our priorities straight. You wonder where something like that comes from.
Yeah, well, it's probably started with one of the chefs of the city, if I had to guess.
I have to say, no, actually, he's come out, the chef you're talking about came out against the ban. He said it should be up to everybody, and there's one prominent chef in Chicago who decided to take foie gras off his menu, but he's come out and said, listen, that's my choice and what I want to do with my menu, and this ban is wrong, wrong, wrong. So he's come out against it.
Yeah, I do think it's wrong. I can understand that someone not wanting to eat foie gras, that's their right. I can understand a chef not wanting to cook foie gras, that's his or her right. But I'm not sure in America that you can start saying to people what they can and cannot eat.
Well, I think that, you know, but the thing is, look, I mean, I'm all for humane methods of animal husbandry. But again, if you look at it, McDonald's chickens are debeaked, are pumped full of hormones. They sometimes have their feathers off. I mean, that's a horrible way to live. A foie gras duck usually lives in a smaller operation, and they see light, and they're fed well. They don't have antibiotics.
Our cows, we dock the tails on our cows. So we cut the tails off. I mean, it's horrible stuff, the way we treat our mainstream animals. I mean...
And so, Nicholas, I mean, we believe, and I'm looking for validation because I think I know your answer, that, you know, foie gras is sort of a unique food. I mean, it's there's nothing like it. If you don't have foie gras, you can't replace it with something else.
That is true. Yeah. It is part of this kind of dining, and it's not the only part of this kind of dining, but it is interesting that with all the problems that we have in America, we're concerned with... this particular issue.
But I do think it's a fine dining issue because, first of all, when you buy foie gras, you buy it in large loaves that one person would never, you know, a family would never have foie gras, would never have a giant lobe of foie gras. So you need to go someplace where they're going to be serving lots of it, so, you know, serving a lot of different people because you would never buy that for yourself. It's also a decadent food that you wouldn't want to have four times a week.
I would. You know,
I said it was a decadent food, and oh look, the decadent guy to my left just said I would.
So Nicholas, I got to tell you, we've been getting this generates a lot of mail, both sides. And if you're a chef anywhere in the world and you think this is crazy, please email us Francis@restaurantguysradio.com or Mark@restaurantguysradio.com. We'd love to hear your opinions on the foie gras ban. It's certainly generating a lot of hate mail as well. It's about 50-50 split. I have been called in the last week via email a troglodyte.
I don't know.
I know I had to look it up. It
means
a caveman. Actually, I was accused of subscribing to troglodyteism, and whoever sent me that email.
But I've seen that whole Geico commercial. You know, they shouldn't throw around disparaging.
There's no such
like
thing
that.
As troglodyteism. It's not like a belief you can subscribe to. You're either a troglodyte and you're not. And I'm not, damn it. I'm not. So anyway, so you're sticking with the foie gras? So am I?
Yes, and send any hate mail to Francis at restaurantguys.
The protesters, the address is...
We'll CC you, Nicholas. Don't worry about it.
It's funny, but Michael Guinor, who runs the Sonoma Valley Foie Gras, he's sort of embattled by this whole thing, but he said, you know, as a result of all the attention that foie gras has been getting because of this, foie gras sales nationally are up 20%.
More people are eating it than ever.
So you want to keep complaining, do it loudly, sing it loud, sing it strong, foie gras is delicious, and keep serving it, and hopefully you'll be able to get it in Central Jersey, and we'll never pass a stupid law like that. Hey, Nick, thanks for coming to talk with us.
My pleasure.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks, Nicholas. We'll talk to you soon.
You're Bye. Listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:25.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys Radio Show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission? To live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The matagatta and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. This is Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. We just had Nicholas Harari on talking about the foie gras ban. And we have joining us in studio today the head sommelier for our organization, for both of our restaurants and our consulting business, a guy named John Kafarski, who comes to talk with us about wine education. Hi, John.
Good afternoon, guys. How you doing?
We're doing good, man.
You know, I asked you to come on the show because your efforts, I mean, you are sommelier of both of our restaurants, and you're doing a bang-up job with that. But you're also pursuing a course of study. Why don't you tell us what options are available to young people who are interested in the wine business? What are the degrees that they could possibly get?
Yeah, besides, you know, the neighborhood wine classes you can take at restaurants in New York, the two major degrees you can go for are the Master of Wine degree, which is known as the MW, and the Master of Sommelier degree, which is the MS. And those two avenues are open for people who want to take their study pretty much to the next level and try and get letters after the name and get some serious accreditation after years of hard work.
And what's the difference between the two degrees?
Masters of Wine normally are writers, do a lot of retail work. They're not necessarily working on the floor of restaurants, as are the Master Sommeliers. They're the ones that work on the floors of restaurants. They do a little less work in the vineyard. They don't really write as much. They do a lot more consulting, things like that.
Where are there more people?
There are more internationally. There's more Masters of Wine than Master Sommeliers. I think it's about 2-1. It's about 250 Masters of Wine and about 125 Master Sommeliers.
Okay,
in the world.
In the world.
Okay, everybody,
in
listen,
the world.
Listen
so
up.
There are more center fielders
right.
playing some type of professional ball
right.
than there are Masters of Wine and Master Sommeliers.
Yeah. Now, these degrees are very serious. I just sat on a tasting panel for a woman who's writing her dissertation for her Master of Wine degree, and I sat with another master, a very famous first American female Master of Wine, Mary Ewing Mulligan, who's going to come on our show shortly. And, you know, this stuff, this is a graduate-level degree. I mean, I think this is a degree that is beyond, say, an MBA, but it's at least at the level of a true master's degree. And it's very serious course of study, and it's a lot of work to do, and you sort of need to be in the business in some way or another to pursue your studies because you need access to tastings and you need access to information.
Right. Most people could never afford to taste all these
things. Right. You can't buy them all, so you have to have access to them for free. And so it's a very serious degree, and when you get that degree, you're part of a very elite club of very few people, and that's pretty interesting stuff. How you go about that, we're going to talk more about with John Kafarski, who's in the process of pursuing that in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants, New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes.
We're talking right now with John Kafarsky. John Kafarsky is the sommelier of our organization. He's the head sommelier of both Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi restaurants. And what that means is he puts together the wine programs, and I'm sort of act as the I'm still somewhat involved, but John helps put together our wine classes, our wine tastings, our wine lists, our Wines by the Glass program, and he helps to train the staff on knowing about wine. And you're also pursuing, John is also pursuing his Master Sommelier degree, which is a pretty serious degree. It's one of two different degrees you can get in wine that really matter as far as the service side of things, as opposed to wine making. And he's come on to talk on the show to talk with us about how exactly that happens. First, let me ask you, John. I mean, you came to work with us as a young college student looking to pay your way through school. What's wrong with you? Why did you stay and change and take on this as a career?
Well, it's interesting. You know, my mom has been a waitress for, 27 and a half years. So I'll be 28 in June. And I think it's a gene. You know, I think it's something that got passed down. You know, I left the business after I worked with her in a diner, and I swore off I'd never work in a restaurant ever again. One, because I worked with a parent, and two, diners are just impossible to work in. So I went to Rutgers, went to school, had some odd jobs, and then I got done working on my senior thesis. I needed some cash, and a buddy of mine worked at Stage Left. He's like, yeah, come on by. The hours are good. You know, you work in restaurants before. It's a fun place to work. It's high energy, and you know, we go out every night. I'm like, oh, man, let's do it. And 3 months later, he quit. I was still there, and I realized that I can make a lot more money as a waiter if I learned about wine, and that's really the only reason I learned it in the beginning. I mean, I knew nothing about wine. I barely knew it was made from grapes.
And now you got bit by the bug.
Yeah, and it's cool. You know, you once you learn a lot about a topic like wine, you get really turned on just for, you know, various reasons.
But. And one of the things that I want to point out to everybody is John has a four-year degree from Rutgers. John's graduated college, and he is now a restaurant professional seeking a graduate degree in order to get his Master of Wine.
Now, what are the steps that you are taking? Why don't you tell people, because I think that a lot of people would be interested in this level on professionalism. What are the steps you take to get your Master Sommelier degree, and where are you in that process?
For the Master Sommelier degree, there's four classes. When I began, there's only three, so I kind of got grandfathered in. But the first class is an intro course. All you have to do is pick up a basic primer on wine, and you can go to, it's like 10 or 12 different cities that offer it. It's a two-day course. It's actually kind of like a vacation. You go out for fun. I went to Vegas about 4 years ago with some buddies. I stayed for the class. And it was a 100-question test, pretty much the basics, you know, grapes of this region, what would you pair with steak type of exam. And it's a lot of fun. You get a lot of exposure to the Quarter of Master Sommeliers. The second part, which is new this year, is called the Certified Sommelier Exam. And that's kind of an out for people who don't want to go to the next level after that. And that's it's a pretty tough test. I took, like, the beta version when I went and sat for the advanced course last year, and pretty much it's a 25-question exam, and it's pretty tough stuff, like appellations within appellations, pretty tough food and wine pairings. And now the hard part for this exam is you have to wait on a table of master sommeliers. And if waiting on you guys is nothing compared to, and this didn't count for me. This was just for fun. They want me to do it just to test the exam. And, you know, I brought over champagne, and I dropped a champagne glass on the floor. Okay.
Just so you know, John, I've never seen John drop a jerk glass of champagne.
Give me a break. And then you have to do a blind tasting of two wines and identify the region the vintage of the wine within a couple of years and the grapes. Then what I'm going for now in Cincinnati in August is the advanced level, which is a 100-question exam, which you get about 4 hours to take. And I don't know how many 100-question exams you've taken in your life, but 4 hours seems pretty scary to me that they give you that much time for 100 questions.
Right, exactly.
And then you have to wait in a dining room, not a table, but a dining room of master sommeliers. So it's about eight tables. And they complain. They have questions. They need recommendations. They spill wine on the table. I mean, you have to react.
Like, sounds like us, Francis.
It sounds like you guys on a Saturday night when you're trying to teach the staff, you know. And then the third part, which I think for me will be the most challenging part, is the blind tasting. Six wines in 25 minutes. And you have to identify – you have to use a deductive method to identify the region, sub-region, grape, year, and any other information about the wine that they want.
Let's go back to the sexy
speed wine tasting.
So let's go back to the sexy part of this thing. So there are, what did you say, 125 master sommeliers?
Yes, about 100. There's about 80 in the United States and about 40 in the UK. So that's about right.
Okay, and so there are only 125 of those ever, and this is called the International Court of Master Sommeliers.
Right.
And for the exam, what, 30 of these guys?
Right.
Of the top 100 guys in the world on wine sit in a dining room. And you've got to wait on them.
And it's funny, you know, they're like rock stars, you know. They know everything there is to know about wine, and they let you know it, you know. I was lucky enough to watch part of the exam last year because I didn't take it. I just went to audit it. And they are 110% true professionals that they encourage you to join their society and to get in and to learn and become one of them. But they make you work for it. And
yeah, sure.
No one gets in because they know people. No one gets in because they're lucky. You have to know what you're doing.
You
pledge a fraternity, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, but you don't have to read as much in pledging the fraternity. I have to say, I knew a woman who took the MS exam, the final exam, and in the practical part of it, the part where you wait on the master sommeliers,
right.
She took the cork out of a bottle of wine, and then it fell on the floor. Now, they're not looking for things to be absolutely perfect, but
right.
If a mistake is made, it's how you recover.
It's a reaction, exactly.
So she dropped the cork on the floor after she pulled out of the bottle of wine, and then she went to pick it up and kicked it across the room. and she said, I never wanted to cry more in my life, but I thought that would be unprofessional. Kicked it, like, clear across the room.
I think crying, though, would complete the trilogy of mistakes there.
There's a lot of reading. I mean, this is a lot of intellectual knowledge here. And,
yeah.
You've been reading pretty voraciously for 4 or 5 years now, right?
Yeah, I went to graduate school after Rutgers, and I didn't finish because I wasn't really into it. But I've never read so much in my entire life. I mean, just this morning I read about 200 pages on Spain, and it's not just reading. It's not a book of fiction. You have to remember these facts and these soils and these regions and this and that. And that's just for one country. And there's about 30 or 40 really serious winemaking countries on this exam. And you need to know it all the way down to what the, you know, to what the subsoil is in some unknown region you can't pronounce, you know.
You know, I want to point out to our listeners that
it doesn't sound like that much fun, John.
It's not. The studying part is not fun. The drinking part's a lot of fun.
I want to point out to our listeners that while master sommeliers, and we have some friends who are master sommeliers, and we have some friends who are masters of wine, with the master sommeliers who are concerned with service in a restaurant, it's important to them, and it's important to them that people who become masters and who are certified at the various levels on the way up to becoming a master know all of this stuff. But the old image of the snooty sommelier who knows everything and tries to put it down that you know that they know everything and put you down, one of the focuses of all of these masters is that they're not learning all this stuff to show off to you. They're learning all this stuff so that they can help you pick the best wine possible, and they don't intimidate you at all at the table.
Right.
They're here to intimidate John.
Yeah.
Right. But they're a resource for the customer. The whole idea of being a great sommelier is you are a resource for the company, you for the customer. You're a wealth of knowledge, and any question they have, or they can get from the sommelier. The sommelier's goal is to please them, is to make them happy,
and to make it
to
as
get
easy
them what they
as
want.
Possible
right.
for you. And there are some wine goobers in the business where I've gone in and there's snooty tableside sommeliers, and I don't care how much you know. If you're snooty, you know, if somebody doesn't know anything about wine, if you're a great sommelier, will come up and say, listen, I want a wine recommendation, and that sommelier will make you feel comfortable and get you a bottle of wine in your price point.
Right.
You know, and here's something else I want to recommend, as long as we're giving advice out there. And John, I know that you agree because, well, you run a wine program.
As long as we're giving advice out there, we do that every day.
When you're dealing with a sommelier, it is not at all rude in any way to say, yeah, you know, we'd like a bottle of wine, something about $50,
right.
Something about $25. So, and you know what? That helps the sommelier immediately to figure out. And if you're uncomfortable stating the price, grab a wine list and point to the price column and say, we're thinking about something like this. And if you're pointing at the wine, we'll know you're talking about Pinot Noir. But if you're pointing at the price, we'll say, aha, he wants something
at whatever
price point it is you're talking about. And that really helps people a lot. Hey, listen, our guest in studio today is our own sommelier, John Kafarski, who's pursuing a master sommelier degree. And we're going to talk with him more about professionalism in wine and how a young person can really come up in the business when we come back from the break. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45. Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants and also of the Restaurant Guys radio show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to RestaurantGuysRadio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis on Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurant. Also of Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurant is our sommelier, John Kafarki. Now, John, one of the things that you have taken over from me, where I am Obi-Wan Kenobi and you are Luke Skywalker.
Oh, golly.
And you're Yoda.
You're more like Darth Vader anyway,
Jabba the
Francis.
Hutt. Anyway, so one of the things, tough crowd, everybody. One of the things that you've really taken over a lot from me is making sure that excitement about wine and information about wine percolates through the staff. So you are now 27 years old, and you are now dealing with the 19, 20-year-olds who can't even drink yet, and the 21 and 22-year-olds who are just starting to discover this magical world of wine. And look, we get people to come in the restaurant. You've got to at least care about wine to work in the restaurant. That's number one. But there are some people who, like, you see the sparkle in their eye. You see that they're jazzed about wine. And other people are like, you know, they'll know what they need to know. But you're responsible for keeping people excited and keeping the information flowing. How are you finding dealing with the people who used to be you?
I know. I mean, especially for the waiters who, you know, don't love wine, but they appreciate it enough because they work with it. I mean, one of the most obvious reasons I tell them to learn about wine is one, it's gonna put some money in their pocket. I mean, it's gonna help them tableside. It's gonna help them, raise their check averages. But another reason is that you have to taste them on wine and give them an idea of what's out there, because most people are intimidated. You know, these kids drink, you know, I call them kids, you know. These guys go out there and they drink, you know, they drink shots and beer all the time. They know nothing about wine. It all tastes the same to them. So what I try and do is I try and sit down and I try and open a couple of wines and show, listen, these are how they're different. And I take them through the wine list and I tell them, like, listen, you guys don't need to be experts. I need to be the expert. I need to know all of the regions and this and that and the minutia. You guys need to know four or five really fun wines. I want you to taste them, and if you like them, tell me about them. Get excited about a tableside because they're real. It's something that a farmer or someone out on the coast made this beautiful product that is intended for the table with this beautiful food, and just get jazzed about it. And I think once you get that spark in them, and once you taste them on it, and once you give them an idea of what's going on, I think it's pretty easy. You know?
One of the things that I think too that you just touched on is, be real about the things that you're talking about.
Right.
Be genuine about the things that you're talking about, because that shows itself. People know, most people know, when you're being fake, when you're pretending either to know something that you don't know or to like something that you don't like.
Right.
And so that's, John touches on a good point. One of the things we're always encouraging our staff to do, recommend things that you like, recommend things that you enjoy. I'll sometimes have a customer come to me and say, oh, do you remember that wine from 7 years ago that you recommended for me? And I'll say, it's 7 years ago. I don't know. But I'll say things like, well, what did I say about it? Oh, well, you said it was made by a garagiste and it was your favorite Pinot Noir at the time. Oh, okay, that was the Star Hill 1995 Pinot Noir. I love that wine. You know, and because I'm real, because I'm telling people what I really think about the wine or the food or any of the other things in my restaurant, it's easy for me to remember those things because I say what I think and what I feel, and I'm better able to service a customer that way.
I think that one of the things that, that we do and that I think great restaurants do is we encourage our staff to drink wine and and to try the food. And we'll open up wines at cost for our staff after work if they want to sit around and share a bottle of wine. And we'll open up wines at...
And for free for classes.
For classes.
And, that's the easiest part for me because now with two restaurants opening up, I have a staff that on weekends, you know, you open up two or three bottles on a weekend on a Friday night, say, and there's, you know, four or five people. It costs everyone $5 or $10 to have a couple glasses of wine, and they get to have it with food, and they get to enjoy the experience that they're trying to provide. A lot of these guys don't understand what we're trying to do sometimes because they don't experience it themselves. So if you put them in a position where they're able to understand the information and understand the beauty and the connection between food and wine, it just makes it that much easier to for them to sell it on the floor because they've experienced it, you know?
I think that the idea is exactly that. It's like, look, I can't take people who don't care about food and wine and don't have a taste for it and teach them about food and wine. And those people tend not to last at our restaurant because it's not that much fun.
Right.
But what we need to do is find people who might have a passion for that and feed that passion. Help them to really love what they're doing. That helps them enjoy their job so they stay longer. And it helps people to, you know, when you go ask a waiter, a lot of people don't want to talk to the sommelier. A lot of people don't want to go further in. And they want to say, you know, I want a bottle of red, something that's really great, something for $50. And if our waiters had four bottles of wine in that price point that are on the list and he likes two of them, and he or she can say, oh, you know what I had last Tuesday? I had this, and I really liked it. Now, that's an honest response and a valid response, you know, for someone starting.
And you gain the customer's trust when you say something like that because there's this one combination. The Armilla Brunello that we have on the list and the Wild Boar, I think, are just is breathtaking. And one of our captains had that a couple of weeks ago when he came in for dinner. And the light just went off. Like, his eyes exploded out of his head, and he finally got it. I think that was what's going to make him a better captain and going to make us a better restaurant and going to make the customers and have a better experience when they come in. And it's a beautiful thing to see that happen.
And it's cool to be 22 years old and be able to recommend this crazy wine with this crazy food. And then you present it to, you know, a sophisticated diner and they look at you like, wow, you're a genius. That's great. Mm-hmm. You know, and you make people happy. And that's what it's all about. Hey, John, thanks for taking the time out of your day to come and talk with us.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Get back to work. Stop goofing off. You can come if you're in the restaurant. You can ask for John. He's the sommelier on the floor of the restaurant. He floats between the two of them. And if you want to talk and get some real great knowledge about wine and we're not around, he's the guy to talk to. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Catherine Lombardi and Stage Left Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Mark.
Hey, Francis. So I just want to tell a quick story. A while back, a very good friend of mine who works for a large pharmaceutical company found out what I made the first 5 years we were open at Stage Left.
Yeah.
And she responded to me, "Why bother?" And I thought,
I was thinking the same thing.
I love my job, Mary, and that was my answer. You know, I really like what I do. Well, anyway, this past weekend, a woman came in to celebrate her birthday with us at Catherine Lombardi Restaurant, and she said, "You know, you guys, it was just such a great experience." And I talked to her towards the end of her meal. You know, it was wonderful, and you could tell she really loved the food and the service and the ambiance, and she really took it all in and was really, really enjoying the entire experience. And you could tell she was really just loving everything about it. And I thought, you know, this is great. And I talked to her for a while and she was having a good time. And so she was obviously having a very good time. And like I said, kind of soaking it all in, really, really experiencing the restaurant.
Yeah.
So I could really tell that she was just soaking it all in, that she was really enjoying everything about her experience in the restaurant. So as I'm talking to her, you know, getting better acquainted with her, she's sitting there and she welled up a little bit. And I said, you know, I noticed. And she said, you know, I just need to tell you, you know, I wasn't, you know, they said that I might not be here for this birthday. And this is really important to me that I am and I'm feeling better and life is beautiful and this is great. And I just want to let you know you in this restaurant really made my birthday. You really made my night. And of course my response to her was what the only thing that it could be was, well, you just made mine.
Yeah.
You know, it was just a really, really special thing. And to Mary, I say, That's why we do it.
Happy birthday. That was a great story. Wow, you didn't tell me that. I'm getting all the shivers. Anyway, I hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey 1450. The time is 12 noon.